I had nothing to say.
You have something to share? No, share with the class.
Go. Start.
Welcome to Still Untitled, the Adam Savage Project. I'm Will.
I'm Adam.
And I'm Norm.
Did you guys see the thing on Laughing Squid today or yesterday where what's his name? I broke down the visual difference in visual comedy and American comedies.
Oh, what's his name? Did Edgar Wright?
It was using Edgar Wright as the example.
So I haven't watched that. It's open on my browser to watch tonight.
It's super. Everybody should watch that.
What's the difference between
physical comedy in Western movies and Eastern movies?
It's not about physical comedy so much as it's about
visual comedy,
cues, like using cuts,
comic
and
timing with
and
cuts, right,
and stuff like that. It brought out all of the examples of, I mean, basically it was like Judd Apatow kind of has ruined American comedy. Because he's like, it's just all about dialogue. Like, American comedy is just about dialogue and improv.
Right.
And then he went through and showed.
Nice. I like that.
Physical comedy in Edgar Wright movies as the modern example of how to do a more visual film.
That's cool. A lot of British shows. There's a show called Inside Number 9. Have you heard of this?
No.
It's the anthology thing,
It's an anthology show where every episode is a different scenario, different cast of characters, but it's all very, very visual.
It all takes place in the same house, right? Or no?
The idea is that it's inside a building that's called Number 9. But
okay,
sure.
Have you been seeing the stuff that Rick Baker's been tweeting?
Yes. No. Oh, it's E.T. stuff. Amazing.
Dude. After Close Encounters, Spielberg, who watched Jaws 2 turn into a nightmare, had a script ready and a bunch of pre-production done on a sequel-ish to Close Encounters of the Third Kind called Night Skies.
Night Skies, I believe.
Okay. And the idea was five different aliens of the same race, but recognizably different.
Yes.
And Baker was thrilled with this project and did a whole bunch of, actually apparently $700,000 worth of maquettes and animatronics for these completely radical and awesome aliens.
We're talking about late 70s, before E.T.
This is before E.T. And it's pretty clear the design of one of his final cute aliens, if you just chop off a little part of the head, it's like almost exactly E.T.
Glowing fingers and everything.
And it's just Baker's Twitter account is phenomenal. I'm retweeting him all the time.
Yeah, I missed that.
Both him and Phil Tippett are just, they have boxes of photos they might be in the studio archives, like for Lucasfilm, that stuff gets doled out occasionally when they sell a new book. But Tippett doesn't care.
No.
He'll just post it.
Yeah. And it's great, great stuff. Stuff you always wondered about. I mean, it turned out there were fans of the idea of Night Skies who'd been wondering what those aliens looked like for the last 30 years.
Wow. God.
And he just tweets these pictures. And it's great. It's this wonderful sort of archival dive through, you know. It's easy to forget with CG that Rick Baker and Phil Tippett invented a genre. I mean, these guys established, along with like Rob Bottin and Stuart Freeborn and all these amazing guys in the late 70s, mid 70s, late 70s, early 80s, just did such unbelievable work.
Of character design.
Yeah, of character design and animatronics and integration of different types of special effects to serve different shots. I mean, just working with great directors. That period of special effects is so fertile and so amazing.
When it set the tone for everything that came for the next 40 years.
Yes.
Did it ever feel like the design of those characters at that time was a reflection of the type of things they would be doing, the puppetry they would be doing? For example, they were constrained because they knew it had to be a maquette of these proportions, of
right.
these size.
Well, I mean, I think, of course, any good designer is going to do that. The thing with Baker is that his engineering is so amazing that he's able to... That actually is not a restriction. Mm. It's actually a thing that allows him to push that to its absolute limit because he knows, one, the mechanics like nobody else does, and two, he's a better sculptor than anybody else. And I don't know if you've ever seen his paintings, but he's an unbelievable painter as well.
And he's still working today.
Yes.
Doing work with 3D printing.
Yeah.
He's amazing in Maya, apparently.
Really?
And has computer models and has now been experimenting with printing out those 3D models and then painting them.
Baker is, he's a kindred soul he and I are kindred souls, building lots and lots of stuff just in every spare moment that we have.
Wow. Gotta visit his shop.
Yes.
Gotta visit his shop.
Yeah. What you gotta do is visit the Frankenstein lab in his house.
Oh.
It's totally amazing.
Interesting. Speaking of people who build stuff all the time.
Well, yeah, you wanted to talk about good enough or tolerance.
Yeah, it's something I was thinking about yesterday because I was working here in the shop.
Yeah.
Working on an upcoming video series we'll have coming in a few weeks now. But you know, when you get down, the thing that I always have to fight against when I'm working on something is this feeling that, you know, if I spend a little bit more time, I can make this perfect versus just getting it good enough to do what it's going to do for the purpose that I need and being done and moving on to the next part or moving on to the next thing or whatever.
Right, right.
And we talked about it a little bit while we were in here. And I think at some point you were like, we should talk about this on the podcast.
Yeah. And it's also came up when I wrote out the 10 commandments for Maker Faire, about measuring carefully and about loose and tight tolerance. I played it for my wife the other night. And when I said that phrase in the speech, the difference between knowing when to use a loose tolerance and a tight tolerance is everything that separates the craftsman from the novice. She said, wow. And I was like, I know, I hadn't really realized that until I'd written down that list and then understood, no, that really is one of the most key things, because anybody who takes enough time can make a violin or a couch. Time is usually the only limiting factor. Even if you have no skill, you can slowly work through every part and every piece and kind of figure it out.
Especially, and tools only reduce the amount of time it takes.
Tools and technique and knowledge reduce the time and make it actually a doable thing. And so there's two phases of the good enough. One is, how do you get things to fit together correctly to move on to the next stage?
Right.
And then there's what is good enough. And then there's also, how do you hide, like, what steps can you take while building that you know you'll be able to hide the crimes of the tool marks and the difficulties and the mistakes that you made?
Right. And so, you know, this came up because I was talking to you about how to cut perfect circles, I think.
Yes.
I think this is where we started.
Yes.
Right?
You said, how do I cut? I'm just no good with a bandsaw, you said. And I said, nobody's good with a bandsaw. I cut outside my pencil line and I use this sander to dial it right in. And I introduce you to the wonder of the 16-inch 220-volt disc sander.
Oh, my gentle Jesus. Okay, so when you introduced this to me, you said, you know, you could feed a 2x4 into this. And I thought, oh, yeah, sure. This is like the time they said you could cut a 2x4 in half with this Leatherman and then did it in 21 seconds. And I mean, you could easily, you could just make wood into dust with that thing.
Yeah.
As fast as you can push.
That's the thing. Every professional model shop I've worked in has one of these giant sanders. Now, just to make it clear, visualize, the disc is 16 inches. The disc itself is a 16-inch, half-inch plate of steel, mm-hmm. perfectly balanced, mounted to this giant 220-volt motor. So it spins at a very, very high speed. I don't know the exact
speed. Seemed like it was a few thousand RPMs at least, right?
Maybe a couple thousand RPM. And when you turn it off, it spins by itself for another 25 minutes.
It's not a portable sander.
You're maneuvering the wood around it.
Yeah, you're moving wood around. It's on a huge stand. It weighs probably 300 pounds.
And you said the only thing you have to do is make sure you always use it on this side. And I thought about the scene in Tommy Boy,
right,
where I'm pretty sure he gets on a disc sander and hucks a oil filter, you know, ping pongs it through the thing. And fear of God, that could actually, you could do that.
That is
a thing that you could do.
You can get into real trouble with a sander in ways that you don't realize. I mean, I've, you know, peeled off chunks of my fingers on those in the past, and you can get work stuck in there. Oh. But that sander is really, really nice and precise and super powerful. And yeah, so nobody makes perfect bandsaw cuts. I mean, yes, there are some people who do, and there are people who do beautiful work with the scroll saw that need almost no finishing. But I am not one of those. I cannot draw with a saw. I use the sanders to finish my work, and that's exactly. It's funny, you did circles, talking about circles yesterday. I was cutting beautiful plex circles today outside the lines, and then just using the belt sander to grace them in. In fact, I wasn't even using it at power because it's too powerful, even with quarter-inch plex. In order to dial it in, I'd turn it on, and then I'd slow it down by shoving a piece of wood in, and then I'd use it spinning down.
Just graze it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the game that I played after a while was, can I sand something? go do something else, and then get back before it stops spinning.
Oh, yeah.
And absolutely, no, every totally. Time.
It's a woodworker equivalent of doing something while the microwave is going down.
Right? Pretty yes, much, exactly. Yeah.
But yeah, so the like, how do you, when you're working on stuff, because I know, I mean, you're working on a project right now that you've been working on for, I think, probably years.
Years, yeah, yeah. 10 years. And I'm close to finishing. I'm close to finishing a whole bunch of long-term projects.
Yeah, it's well, one of the things we've noticed after, 2 years of coming into your shop here is that there are periods of thinking, and then there are periods of massive amount of work happening where you'll come in, where I can come in 3 days in a row and something has dramatically changed each day.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it seems like we're in the latter right now.
We are totally in the latter right now. And it's not that I'm spending less time in the shop than normal. I'm only coming in for like 25 minutes every morning before work to just do one thing and then head out to go work.
So how do you keep, so I was working on a super simple project.
Right.
You're working on stuff that's very complex, has lots of pieces, has electronics, has lights, has, you know, all sorts of stuff that has to go together. How do you keep from getting, if you're working on something you've been working on for 10 years, how do you dodge the perfect get good enough?
Well, so there's a bunch of things. One is the stuff I'm working on now is to be weathered, so I can beat the crap out of it and it's just more drastic.
Hide crimes.
Yes. Two is I do a lot of thinking. And so I encounter lots of problems that I then just stop working while I think about the problem. And so
why the ZF1 has taken 20 years to put together?
Exactly. Okay. And so I hit a thing where it's like, oh my gosh, you know, it's these side plates, which I have at 58 millimeters, which I need to re-water cut a bunch of panels because they're actually supposed to be 52 millimeters apart. I finally learned from someone who worked on the actual guns, and it's killing me. But wait. I'm getting away from myself. Understand when I'm thinking through a project and I'm trying to avoid the pitfalls, the only way I'm successfully avoiding the pitfalls is the fact that I've screwed up in all of the ways that I am now avoiding. So like I've built enough things when I've fucked up in every way possible in all of these things.
On different projects.
Yeah. And I still screw up. I mean, I was just telling you today, I was like trying to get too fancy by joining four separate parts with the same bolt. What a nightmare for alignment and, you know, getting it.
Considering that two of them are spherical, yeah.
Yes, it was ridiculous. What do you want to bet? Five of the first six comments are people guessing what project we're talking about.
They've guessed.
Oh, yeah. Somebody's right.
It is only through hard-won experience that I know I can't do it this way. I have to slow down and do it that way. Or I could do it this way, but it's actually faster if I just throw some epoxy on there and cut it off later. Go ahead.
And does the order of operations also inform you where, like if you cheat in one side, in one direction, then we're at the end, as opposed to going the other way around, then you can hide more crimes in one place.
Exactly. The order of operations is almost everything. It is really the key thing. And it's really difficult. That just takes a sense where you kind of build it in your head, wondering, how am I screwing up? And you just build it. And you're like, oh, okay, if I do that first and I don't have this properly cut, I'm going to need to build it once, then take it all the way apart to fit that and then build it again. And it's like, you know, I'm lazy. I don't want to do that.
Right.
I hate making things twice. It drives me crazy.
Well, you know, and if you're like, so I was doing stuff with glue and, you know, it turns out glue is pretty permanent.
Yes.
So when you're into that kind of thing, I initially thought, oh, I'll just get to this point and then I'll wing it from here because I'll figure it out.
Right.
But that doesn't work.
Yeah. You really have to. You also learn. You can consider each operation in making something a door. Mm-hmm. Now, there are some doors you can come back through and some doors you can't, right? Mm-hmm. And glue is a door you can't come back. Actually, you can come back through the glue door, but it is a giant pain in the ass.
You don't want to go back through the glue door.
No, you're going to have to go to the keymaster.
Yeah.
The trick is you have to wonder, is this the Roach Motel? Is this a one-way door or is it a two-way door? If it's a one-way door, I better think through all of the rest of the operations before I complete this one.
And it's not necessarily that you save all the one-way doors to the end.
No.
Because that's not how it works.
No, you can't. I mean, you know, it's like the number of times I've gotten to the end of machining something for 3 hours, I'm tapping with a 256 tap, which is a really fine little tap, and I'm going too fast because I'm impatient, and it's like I got 5 minutes left before I got to go meet somebody at dinner, and I snap the tap in this piece and thus lose 6 hours worth of work. I've done that. I think I did that 4 weeks ago. The my solution on that front was because I was tapping a hole for a screw that was dressing. I ground the top of the tap. I took the screw that goes there. I cut off the head and glued it over the tap.
Well, but I mean, in all of the stuff that I've done that involves building something or repairing something or whatever, the mistakes that are the costly ones are always, almost always, I won't say always, but almost always the, oh man, I got to be someplace in 20 minutes. I better hurry up and finish this.
Yeah.
And then you end up having to go back and do tons of work over.
Because you, yeah.
Because I was an asshole.
You sprayed it basically. And the room is still dusty and now the dust is in your spray coat and stuff like that. And it's like, it's funny because...
Sorry, as we're talking about dusty, it, by the way.
What?
Sorry, the room is still dusty.
Oh, no,
dusty,
I don't care. The thing I was going to say is this is all. I'm sure there are some people at the beginning of this podcast who are like, oh, I can't wait for some hints about how to hide crimes. And it's like, it's too big a subject. I can't even go near, like, what do you do with plywood? What do you do with plastic? What do you do with styrene? You know, you learn that there are materials that are really forgiving. For instance, styrene is super forgiving where acrylic is not.
What's styrene?
Styrene is like white, it's like model plastic from a model kit.
Okay.
That's all styrene. And you can buy it in sheets, and it's what you use for vacuum forming and thermoforming. Styrene, I can build anything out of styrene and in minutes using weld on glue and sanding sticks. And it's incredibly versatile and super forgiving. You can even have a hole and you can patch it in minutes. Mm-hmm. Acrylic, harder, more difficult to use. It cracks, it shatters, it doesn't glue very fast. You know, so you end up choosing materials that allow you to do that kind of thing. As far as the hidings of the specific hidings, as far as hiding the specific crimes in each of those materials, it really is like thinking through that build. It's like so much of my building process is now mental.
So when you were learning how to do this stuff and you were starting out, were you picking projects because of, I mean, I know a lot of times you were picking projects because you would get a new tool or you know, something like that. But I mean, it seems like you were collecting skills at the same time and you were picking projects based on, or maybe even like the thing I was working on, I chose the approach I chose so I could learn a couple of new things. I knew kind of what I was going to learn going into it, but I wasn't really sure.
No, I totally did. I totally did that.
Okay.
I did a lot of that. I also, you know, I was lucky enough when you're working in special effects, you're always around people who know tons of crap that you don't know. And you get to watch them go. And it's really, really thrilling and an incredible education.
I mean, spending time watching someone in the shop, whether it's, I mean, we do videos where we get to watch you in the shop all the time that you learn something every time there, but going and standing and, hey, can I help you in your shop? Is there anything I can do to help? And then just watching and absorbing and learning is a wonderful way to learn new
stuff. I'll tell you a story from Industrial Light and Magic, because one of the greatest thing about working there was the sharing of information. There were some people that hoarded their information. You know who you are, you guys. There were some people who hoarded their information, but mostly it was a very egalitarian atmosphere. And so at one point I was working on Space Cowboys and we needed this radar dish and it needed to be, you know, like a gusseted steel frame armature.
Like R2's periscope one?
Yeah, or? Sort of like that, okay. But even more complicated given the art director's drawing. And I tried something that hadn't been done before, which was I laser cut something and then I thermoformed a laser cut thing. And so what I did was I laser cut this elaborate sort of lattice structure as a flat piece of 16th inch plex. And then I knew the bowl that I wanted. So I lathed the bowl in a modeling plastic called Ren Shape, a modeling urethane. And I lathed both sides of the bowl. I lathed the negative, concave, and a convex.
Okay.
And then I put the concave underneath a vacuum form heater. And I laid the acrylic on top of it. And then once it was soft, I pressed the top on. Now, the moment I'm doing this, Lauren Peterson comes over. Lauren Peterson, one of the gods of model making. Lauren Peterson is the guy that found cyanoacrylate glue at Eastman Kodak, bought it in this large brown bottle, and introduced crazy glue to model making, which is It wouldn't exist without model making. Lauren Peterson, if you've ever seen a shot of a guy sanding the teeth of the puppet that try of the worm that tries to grab the Empire Strikes Back worm. That's Lauren Peterson. And he's just one of the original model makers from Star Wars. He's a good friend of mine and an amazing model maker. So I'm doing this slumping and I've got to do like 8 of them or something like that. Actually, I've got it here. I've got one here in the shop. I'll pull it out. And you can take a picture and we can show people.
Yeah, I'll use it as a show art.
Lauren comes over and he goes, "What are you doing?" And I said, "I'm slump forming laser cut stuff." And he goes, "I've always wondered if that was possible. Oh, that's really cool. Wait, let me see. Oh, that's great." And they were like lining up like potato chips. And then like other people start coming over. "I heard you were slump forming some laser cut stuff. And come over. What's that? So what did you do? How did you figure this out? Da, da, da." And this exchange of information. We're like bumblebees. Like, here's the way to the flower. And it was so thrilling to be part of that process.
Well, and everybody who's coming over and talking to you has to have a different set of mistakes and lessons that they've learned doing similar stuff.
Right.
And then they can apply and everything comes out better as a result.
Exactly. And here's, you know, so that happened constantly. And if somebody was doing something really cool, you'd hear about it within a few minutes. "Hey, you know, Rodney's working on something really neat. Mark Buck's working on something," that kind of thing.
Well, this is one of the things I like about like communal workspaces, whether it's a hackerspace or tech shop or something like that, where you go in, there's a bunch of people working on stuff. Everybody's, for the most part, like you said, pretty open about what they're doing and like giving advice. "Oh, hey, I've never used this before. You know, what should I know if I want to come in and do something like you're doing right now?" And everybody shares information. And as a result, everybody's stuff ends up better.
You know, and for anybody out there, frankly, and I want to speak to this because I said it at Maker Faire again, no secrets. For anybody out there who gets asked how they do something because they came up with a really cool technique and they don't want to reveal it because somehow they feel that it's proprietary to them, and if someone else has that technique, they're going to do stuff that somehow infringes on them personally, or just don't keep your information a secret. How did you learn the stuff you did? You learned it from people that showed you what they knew. You've got to pay that back by showing other people the stuff that you figured out. It's really vital. It's the only way that process works. You have to give back into that.
And if you don't share, you get hit by a bus tomorrow. It's gone forever.
It
or
is.
Or at least until the next person figures it out.
And it's like you're never... It's not like you're going to, it's not linear. You're not ahead of someone or behind someone.
No.
You're working on your own thing.
And so it's this comedian whose name is escaping me right now, Chris Hardwick, told me that line that I used at Maker Faire, which is you have a monopoly on being you. And, you know, I added to that, if you think the technique that you're using is what makes you special, you're an idiot. Because it's not. It's the things you do with your technique. And so, you know, don't hide the fact that you use latex in your gouache or whatever you used as the sealer and stuff like that. Special effects is full of people sharing information, and it's really awesome. And it's just like nothing to me is more exciting than learning something that someone else is excited about. And nothing makes me madder when someone's like, "I'd rather keep that a secret."
But I mean, the hiding crimes, figuring out how to do stuff the fast way, and then, you know, like watch it. If you want to know how to do stuff, and I know you said it's too big a topic, but go watch some of the box videos, specifically the Winston one, where we went through like 4 or 5 different iterations trying to get down to where we were, something that would fit in the TSA size wise thing, more or less, and B, something that held the beaver.
Right.
You know, you went through this whole process and you started off with a pretty big box and just kept cutting it down until all of a sudden we had the right size box for Winston and the TSA, and everybody was happy.
And I'm comfortable with that kind of process. I like sort of, I know that there's a lot of people and they do really wonderful work by drawing everything out in advance, but I need the materials to speak to me while I'm working.
Well, the downside of doing it that way is you tend to waste some materials.
Yes.
But if you keep your scraps, you almost always find a use for them, in my experience.
Jamie points out, he and I will take the same amount of time to get to a finished project, but he'll build it once and I'll build it 3 times. And frankly, I think I've learned a lot more along the way.
But you've built it 3 times to get to one finished build.
Yes.
Because you said earlier, you don't like rebuilding things.
I
feel like a lot of people, when they start on a project or just learning, they don't want to build the thing they want because they feel like they have the most energy and the most willpower to get to that. But once they get to that, it's not going to be as good as if they had, you know, 5 years more experience later and went back to it.
Yeah.
But you've done that for like Blade Runner gun. So is that difficult to build the thing you want and then find the motivation again to rebuild it, having all that experience?
Sometimes yes and sometimes no. It depends upon. So one of my main techniques for making stuff is I almost never make a single one of anything anymore. I always make 2 or 5 or 10. Mm-hmm. It's not that much harder, and it allows me enough parts. Like if I want to make 3 of something, I'll buy enough parts to make 5. Mm-hmm. Because I guarantee I will screw up in some way enough that I'll be wanting for parts at Sunday at 6 a.m. or something like that. And it also allows me to solve problems on a throwaway piece. Right. That I can fix on the final piece.
Or more importantly, it takes the risk out of that first piece.
It does. It totally does. And yeah. Allows you to kind of like, I wonder if this cut will work. Nope.
Or not, yeah. Just risk the burden of that first piece to, yeah, be perfect.
And when you're working on, like, it's like, you know, if I'm making some sort of space helmet and I'm cutting acrylic to size, the acrylic takes a while. You have to order it from acrylicdomes.com, I think. And it takes a couple of weeks to get there. And if you screw up the one you have or you crack it, you're really boned for a while. So if I ever have a visor to order, I order 2 or 3 so that I've got the frangibles, the ones that I can mess up. Yeah. Removing that burden of having to make the perfect cut in the single piece, it's really key. And look, I recognize that not everyone can afford to do that. But you know, you can afford to do it with small projects that you're doing. Make 2 sets of parts, cut 2 sets of pieces of plywood, cut 2 sets of plastic, laser cut 2 sets of the parts that you need so that you can really figure out how it should go.
And then when it comes to hiding, when you make the mistake, instead of saying, well, shit, I better throw that out and start over, figure out, can you cut the top of the tap off and glue the top of the screw on?
Yeah, or can you sand the whole thing down and hit it with a coat of spray paint? Can you plasti dip it? I mean, there's a lot of ways that you can hide crimes at the end of something.
Can you get the disc sander out and just feed that 2x4 into it?
Sanding is, you know, it's funny, when I taught at the Academy of Art College, which I did in like 99, 2000, around there, I didn't realize that sanding was something that could fill an entire chapter of a book to get people to understand. It's a really key thing to understand the minute taking off of material with the sander. And what a lot of people don't realize is that they're either not using their sander robust enough, like just plow your material into it, cut loose, sand close, or they're not sanding subtly enough. Like when I'm working on a model, like a museum quality model, I'm taking a sanding stick of like a, you know, 220 grit sanding fingernail
like
sander.
A nail file.
Yeah.
File, yeah.
And I'm going, whoosh, whoosh, whoosh. I mean, it's literally like one pass and looking, and it gets so, so subtle. Moving down through that, you know, from 80 grit all the way up to 400 grit and then polishing something, it's a whole set of processes that if you do it wrong, will take you 5 times as long.
Yeah, if you start with 220 instead of 80, it's going to take forever.
Oh, and the number of times I would see students with a piece of 120 grit that was totally caked smooth with material, sitting there, keep on going. Buy 10 sheets of sandpaper. Don't buy 1 sheet. Well, buy 10 sheets and keep throwing them out.
When you go to the sandpaper aisle at Home Depot, they have 1 sheet, they have 5 sheets, and they have 60 sheets.
Right. Get the 60.
60 sheets is the way to go.
Let me tell you, get the 60 sheets. It's a big deal.
And change it. Change it all the time.
Keep changing. You know, I also don't use whole sheets of sandpaper. I rarely use whole sheets of sandpaper. I put a ruler on and I rip off the little pieces that I need, little tiny pieces. I fold it up and just keep on. Is it caked up? Okay, throw it out, get another one.
When I realized that my orbital sander was sized to take 1/4 of a sheet of sandpaper,
yes.
It's like, oh, this changes everything. Sand 4 times as much.
Yes.
Anyway.
Exactly.
So I think that's a good place to end.
I think that's a good place to end. I'll tell you something. This is a great place for questions. In the comments for this podcast, I'd love anyone have specific questions about hiding crimes and workflow and stuff like that. I know there's stuff that we're not thinking about that would be fun to cover in this topic, and we can include it the next time.
Yeah, we can actually, if... See, this will go up and it may not be the next one, but maybe the one after that, we'll do a follow-up where we just answer questions you guys post.
That'd
so on YouTube and on the site. So that'll do it for us today.
Thanks for joining us.
We'll be back next Tuesday, most likely, with another episode of Still Entitled. If you like us, leave a review, or don't like us, whatever, leave a review on iTunes, post feedback on YouTube, leave a comment on the site.
We are less thrilled if you leave a negative.
You know what? Negative feedback is good.
Oh, you're right. You're
as
right.
As long as it's constructive feedback is
right.
good. Negative or positive.
So 15-year-olds need not apply with their internet anger and vitriol?
I like to think that there's a period of time, 9 months before the onset of hardcore puberty and about 2 years after the onset, that people should not be allowed on the internet, male or female.
I'm sure there's some of them listening right now going, I'm okay, I'm a nice guy. I totally
I'm
get
sure
it.
Yes, they you are. You totally absolutely,
don't mean to paint everyone with the same
brush. Nope. Not all 14-year-olds are evil. Just all the ones I've ever met.
My kids aren't bad.
They're fine.
They're pretty
polite. 14-year-olds, they're pretty 15, good.
And they're 15.
Yeah, see, they're out of the window now.
Okay. That's the longest wrap-up in history.
Yeah, I know. Bye.
Bye.
See ya.